Today on Against the Grain. They shut down the Las Vegas Strip when the casinos were operated by the mafia and waged a grassroots fight against racism and poverty. The struggle of African-American poor mothers for welfare rights in Nevada is a story with lessons for our times of punitive austerity. Historian Annalise Ehrlich has documented one of the forgotten but key social struggles of the 1960s and 70s. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In 1971, thousands of poor Black women shut down the Las Vegas Strip and occupied Caesar's Palace Hotel and Casino in protest of welfare cuts in Nevada. They were joined by left celebrities like Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland, partly to ensure that the mobsters who owned the casinos would not shoot into the crowds of protesters. Led by those within their ranks, such as Ruby Duncan, these women subsequently founded Operation Life, considered one of the most successful programs of the War on Poverty era. Annalise Ehrlich is professor of history at Dartmouth College. Her book, Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty, which has been published in a revised edition by Beacon Press, is the basis of a PBS Independent Lens documentary of the same name. Annalise, can you start by describing what Nevada was like in the 1950s and 60s, the ground out of which the poor women's social movement emerged?
Nevada itself was quite a wide open, libertarian place. It was a center of defense production, which began during World War II. Basic Magnesium plant drew a lot of folks from the South to come in and try to work there. Las Vegas itself was a Jim Crow town. It had grown some from its early days as a stop on the transcontinental railroads, because there were springs, there was water. It had boomed a little bit as a result of Boulder Dam, which became Hoover Dam in the 30s, and then the World War II defense industry, and ultimately the nuclear test site, which was the Trinity test site, was about an hour from Las Vegas. The famous era of strip development started in 1947 with Bugsy Siegel's Flamingo Hotel, and a lot of the famous hotels went up during the 1950s, the Sands and the Stardust and the Desert Inn. And so those were the hotels that drew the city's early Black population, and the hotel unions, a lot of folks who built the hotels had come, you know, from eastern cities. And so when they imagined recruiting labor for the hotels, they looked back east. And there was a Black woman business agent by the name of Sarah Hughes, representing the Culinary Workers Union, who literally went to the cotton fields in the Mississippi Delta, Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, to try to recruit people to work in the hotel industry, the men as porters and car valets, and the women as housekeepers and kitchen help.
So the African-American women who were eventually to organize themselves, did they come from the South like the workers that you were describing? And where did these workers end up primarily working?
The women who would make up Clark County Welfare Rights Organization, Operation Life, the women who stormed Caesar's Palace in 1971, and who this book is about, all came from pretty much three Delta towns: Tallulah, Louisiana; Fordyce, Arkansas; and Greenville, Mississippi; and some from Vicksburg, Mississippi. And you know, it was like any other chain migration. It started with, you know, a few men who went out in the late 30s to work on the Boulder Dam. And then, you know, you had family chains. Then guys would go to work out on, you know, work in the early hotels or in the military plants, and would bring members of the family. So yes, every one of the women who Storming Caesar's Palace focuses on had been sharecroppers, literally the last cotton pickers. And you know, that's, those were stories they liked to tell, because the decision to move to Las Vegas was really rooted in their childhood, their you know, teenage determination that whatever else their futures held, their children would not pick cotton. And Las Vegas offered, you know, alternative kinds of labor and a means of living.
Well, tell us a bit more about the employment there. Of course, the casinos were and are famous, and also famous for being tied in with the mob and organized crime. Now, Las Vegas is known as a union town. Back then, what were the conditions of work for people in the casinos, especially, and in the hotels, especially since you could find yourself on public assistance and also work for these employers, since much of it was seasonal?
Yeah, so when the people this story is about, Ruby Duncan and Rosie Seals and Alversa Beals from Tallulah, Emma Stampley from Vicksburg, Mississippi, Essie Henderson from outside Houston, Texas, they were excited at the experience of their early employment in Las Vegas for a couple of reasons. Alversa Beals talked about how you know, the business agent from the union had not been lying when she said you could make in a day what you made in a week in the cotton fields. And when she got her first check after 2 weeks of labor cleaning rooms in the Flamingo Hotel, she was amazed. She remembers asking her sister, is this check real, right? Did I really make that much money? So, you know, the initial feeling was you could, you know, you could multiply by several times your income. And as Alversa said, and you didn't, you could work in the shade. You didn't have to be out in the hot sun. So the early experience of Las Vegas labor was a good one. The industry was already unionized. And in fact, the early deals had been made with the mob hotel owners. The idea being that if we give our workers pretty good wages, decent conditions, and they agree not to strike, then the hotels and the casinos will run smoothly, and the flow of dollars into the coffers of the owners and also into state tax coffers, because Nevada was the only state in the union at that time with legalized gambling, would not stop, right? The money would keep flowing. So for the women, the wages that they earned and the fact that they had a union representing them was really, really important. Ruby Duncan tells a story about having, you know, been asked, she'd worked her shift, and at the end of the day, her supervisor said, there's a convention coming in and you have to work tonight as well. And she said, I have 7 children at home, I can't do that. And she was fired, and she went to her union business rep, Sarah Hughes, who came back and said, hey, that's not our contract, right? The contract says you can't suddenly spring night work on people. And Ruby remembered going in and talking to the supervisor, who was a white woman from Florida, and she said, basically, you may not know it, but slavery is over. And she did use those words. And so there was a lot that Las Vegas offered in the beginning. There was a lot that it didn't offer as well. The west side of Las Vegas and the shadow, you know, of the strip during the Rat Pack glamour era was a very different kind of place. There were, I think, 80% of housing was considered substandard in a federal housing survey from the early 1950s. There was raw sewage in the streets. There were people living in housing that Mary Wesley, another of the activists I write about who came from Mississippi, thought were chicken coops when she first saw them. People had blankets hanging over their doors, over their house fronts for doors. They, you know, often had outdoor outhouses, washed their hands and cooked over open fires sometimes. So the west side of Las Vegas was what the Harlem Renaissance writer Honor Bontemps called a mud town. And there were mud towns in, you know, in California. There were mud towns in many parts of the country where there was wartime defense production. And the idea was that if you don't give these black workers services, they'll just go home when the war ended. But for all the reasons that you can imagine, life was still better in the West, and they didn't go back. But Las Vegas was also segregated. It was a segregated town until 1965, which created a lot of a lot of entertainment and hotels and businesses on the Black West Side of town as years went on and you started to get a little bit better infrastructure and conditions there. But you couldn't go to the Strip. They could work in the back of the hotels and in the cleaning rooms, but they couldn't go for an evening's entertainment on the Strip until after protests in the early 60s. And in 1965 is when Las Vegas became an integrated town.
What was the welfare system like in Nevada in the 1960s while people lived in the conditions that you've been describing?
The welfare system, Nevada had the second lowest benefits in the country, second only to Mississippi. There's been some contention over whether it was exactly second or whether Alabama was in there too. But the bottom line was that Nevada, which was called the Mississippi of the West, had very, very, very low welfare benefits. And part of that was, the libertarian culture of the state. You know, you don't take handouts from anybody. But after a while, as the casino and hotel business began to develop, the state officials and hotel owners both realized that at that time, the Las Vegas tourist industry in its early years was very much seasonal. And, they didn't want to pay workers when there were not enough people coming to stay in the hotels or play on the slot machines and the craps tables. But they didn't want them to leave town either, because they wanted them to be able to be called up at a moment's notice if there was a convention or if business picked up. And they began to realize that if people could apply for public assistance, then they might have just enough to feed their children and, to keep roofs over their heads, no matter how inadequate those roofs were, during the seasons when there were not benefits. Now, at that time, So the hotels actually began to help women who worked there apply for public assistance if they were eligible, if they were single moms. And so that's what would start to happen. You'd get laid off seasonally, but your supervisor at the hotel would be helping you to apply for aid. And so the welfare system, got entrenched in Nevada, and it developed as something that served the hotel and casino industry and the state at least as much, if not more, than it served the poor people who received welfare.
Can you remind us, since this is a big part of this story, about the history of what has come to be known as welfare, that is, aid to families with dependent children, preceding the 1960s, in which this story sort of unfolds? What was the history of such programs in the U.S.?
The program has its origins in 1935 with the passage of the Social Security Act, the cornerstone of the American social safety net. And it's one of the reasons I decided to tell this story as a collective biography, because these women and their story span, this entire period of guaranteed federal aid to the poorest mothers and children in the country. Which was Title IV of the Social Security Act, which said that, some kind of floor below which we don't let the poorest mothers and kids fall is an entitlement of citizenship. So it started out as aid to dependent children because there was resistance to the idea of giving it to mothers. And, but it in its initial years, it had a kind of positive gloss of, we're going to give this money to women maybe whose husbands were killed in the First World War, or, whose husbands had disappeared looking for work and never come back during the Depression. And increasingly, it came to be seen, and this was especially true during and after the Civil Rights Movement, as something that disproportionately benefited Black women and Latino women. So, early on, there was a certain amount of resistance, the idea being that, especially in the South, where and in agricultural zones, where the labor of these women was needed periodically in the fields, or, people wanted workers as to do their laundry or domestic work. They wanted to be able to put people on the rolls and take them off, very much as I just described happened in the Las Vegas hotel industry. And so in order to get the law passed and in order to get it reauthorized from time to time, the Roosevelt administration was willing to allow each state to make its own rules. So essentially what you got was 50 different welfare systems. And states had laws like employable mother, clauses which said you could kick everybody off, for example, during the agricultural season when you wanted pickers in the fields. And that didn't only happen in the South, it happened in New Jersey, it happened, you know, in the West, it happened in many parts of the country. So that was the welfare system. And this is the system that the women entered when, you know, they began as hotel workers, but also many of them became injured because the work was brutal on their bodies, and also because they had more children than they wanted to sometimes. You know, they couldn't get access to birth control. That was an early part of the struggle that this book talks about, as these women sought to, if they couldn't get access to birth control, to have their tubes tied. And for all these reasons, and the physicality of both cotton field work and hotel housekeeping, you know, many of them ended up injured. Ruby Duncan slipped on a slick of oil in the kitchen of the Sands Hotel when she was working as a kitchen worker and really damaged her coccyx at the bottom of her back and was in terrible pain after that. Couldn't do that kind of work anymore. Mary Wesley ended up in the hospital with a dental infection because, you know, nobody had dental care at that time. So for all of these reasons, you know, women often ended up on public assistance. And it was a time when it had become associated with Black women and with civil rights activism, and you began to get a generation of politicians influenced by California Governor Ronald Reagan, who started to talk about Reagan's slogan when he ran for California governor was "No more pay for play." The idea being that, you know, of course these women, you know, don't really work. Which is, you know, palpably ridiculous if you learn about the, you know, backbreaking labor they did in the cotton fields, the backbreaking labor they did as, you know, hotel workers. But that was the public perception. It was a racist, sexist perception. And one of the people who was influenced by the California governor was a former Kennedy administration a Job Corps administrator, George Miller, who liked his job in the Job Corps, as he said, taming wild boys, but didn't know what to make of these women with children without husbands. And he was very interested in the idea of using Nevada as a place of experimentation to cut people off the welfare rolls. And that's what would happen in 1971.
I'm speaking with historian Annalise Orlick about her book, Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty, which is published in a revised edition by Beacon Press. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you're just mentioning George Miller in Nevada, the state director of welfare, and this shift that was happening to associate welfare, particularly with Black women, and with a presumption that they were drawing welfare unfairly and defrauding the system. Can you tell us about Miller's efforts to investigate and basically terrorize women to see if they could be thrown off of welfare?
So George Miller had attended a conference that had been convened by then California Governor Reagan, and he was interested in using Nevada to experiment with major cuts. He really believed that that these women were a drain on state coffers, and he almost volunteered himself because he said, you know, you can't experiment with mass welfare cuts in a state like California or New York or Illinois or Massachusetts, where there was so many, you know, so many people who were getting public assistance. He said, but Nevada's a small state with a small population and a deeply ingrained libertarian opposition to any kind of public assistance. So he kind of volunteered himself. And what he did was he had been very actively engaging in what came to be known as midnight raids. And midnight raids were a practice whereby the state welfare departments, county welfare departments, would send caseworkers into recipients' houses in the middle of the night, right? It was this terrifying knock on the door in the middle of the night, and they'd come into the house when everyone was sleeping, wake everybody up, and start looking for evidence that a man might be present in the house, or, you know, even if the man wasn't there, you know, presuming they would presume that the man was hiding, they looked for razors, they looked for cigars, they looked for, you know, anything, men's clothes. So they're going through people's closets, they're going through people's drawers. This practice was actually outlawed by the Supreme Court in 1968 in King v. Smith. The idea had been that there was rules in many of these welfare state programs that said a substitute father, if found, could be deemed responsible for the financial support of the children. So even if this was not the actual father of the children, or even a long-term boyfriend of a woman, or even if this person might be a male relative visiting, any sign of a man, you know, was sufficient to throw the family off public assistance. So this had been outlawed in 1968 in King v. Smith, but Miller was still doing some of this in Las Vegas, and I interviewed a bunch of caseworkers at the social work school at the University of Nevada, Reno, many years later, and they said that Miller actually insisted that caseworkers carry loaded guns when they went into these for these midnight raids. So, you know, that was like, you know, to perpetuate the idea that these women were somehow dangerous. So you're going into a house that's got, you know, a mother and sleeping children, generally speaking. Why you needed a gun is a question. And most of these caseworkers said they left the gun at home. They wouldn't do it because they were afraid that, you know, a child might jump out and startle them and they would shoot them. So but it did perpetuate this notion of these women as somehow dangerous to the rest of society.
So how did both the kind of larger context in which women were finding themselves in need of public assistance in Nevada, in a still highly segregated and unequal place, especially in Las Vegas, how did the women who ended up organizing themselves become catalyzed to do so? And what was sort of the larger political context, I guess, out of which they started organizing?
The direct catalyst was George Miller's decision to cut the benefits, cut one-third of the state's recipients off the rolls entirely, drastically slash the benefits of another third, and slightly by pennies raise the benefits of the remaining third in January 1971, saying that he, you know, through these midnight raids and audits and other kinds of investigations, calling these women into the welfare office to grill them about their, you know, their personal lives. Did they have jobs under the table? Did they have boyfriends? All of that, that had revealed that there was only one third of the recipients in the state were, quote unquote, deserving, the deserving poor. And, you know, the others were either getting too much or, you know, defrauding the state entirely. Now, remember, the idea of defrauding was simply based on, it was based on these arbitrary rules that we've been talking about. So it could mean you had a boyfriend. It could mean you had a job under a table. Now, you know, in the late 60s, the welfare benefit for a family of four in Nevada was about $144 a month. So that obviously was too little to live on, you know, even such a long time ago. And so people had to work, right? That was part of it, is that the welfare system was structured to enable people, to force people to work under the table, right? So that, you know, they couldn't protest, right? It was to create a cheap labor force. And, you know, the larger political context, you know, in this moment of the late 60s, you know, into 1970, 71, was that across the country, there were women on public assistance who had begun to analyze the ways in which the system was set up to guarantee a cheap labor force, the ways in which the system was like, in the words of the national leader of the welfare rights movement, Johnny Tillman, who was herself a recipient. She said it was like a super sexist marriage, right? You know, the man controlled everything. And you know, you couldn't argue or your children would end up hungry. So, you know, women began to organize beginning in LA in 1963, when Johnny Tillman organized the first welfare rights group. People began to organize with Beulah Sanders in the city of New York. And in 1966, a former Syracuse University chemistry professor, George Wiley, and a Columbia and CUNY political scientist couple, Richard Cloward and Frances Fox Piven, worked together with Tillman and Sanders to pull together a national organization of welfare recipients under the title of the National Welfare Rights Organization. And it was an organizer in Las Vegas for a local group called the Equal Opportunity Board, which was paid by War on Poverty money, right? That's the other bit of this context, that from 1964 to 1980, you know, there's a great deal of federal funding for local and community organizing by poor people, you know, via Lyndon Johnson's Declaration of War on Poverty, you know, beginning in 1964. So there was money, you know, for organizing, and one of these organizers, Mother Pearson, came to Alversa Beals' door in the Marble Manor housing project in the West Side, because the West Side had been built up a little bit by this time. People at least weren't living in shacks, because federal interstate highway money was paired with building the first housing projects there. Anyway, the organizer came to her door and told her about the welfare rights movement, and Versa Beals said, wow, it was the first time I'd heard the words welfare and rights in the same sentence. The idea that, you know, I was entitled to certain benefits for the work I did raising my children. And so she and another migrant from the same town in Louisiana, Rosie Seal, started the Clark County Welfare Rights Organization in 1967 as part of this national movement. And but Rosie was sick, and so in 1968, the leadership of that group was handed over to Ruby Duncan, also from Louisiana, from Tallulah, who had been a hotel worker. I talked about her a little bit earlier. She was a union activist, and she had been severely injured slipping in that kitchen accident. And Ruby began to organize. They all did. And the organizing took two forms. The first was, you know, in the early stage of the group, as Rosie Seals, the group's first president, put it, being poor is depressing, you know. And so she, you know, they found mothers who were just paralyzed by depression at the state they were living in, and at seeing their hungry children, and at not having a decent pair of shoes to send their kids to school with on the first day of school, and having hungry children who had, you know, headaches and couldn't learn. And so it was these mothers' experiences that you know, became the platform that these women would start to organize around. But first, Rosie said, she'd go into a house and find, you know, a mother just paralyzed by depression, babies in dirty diapers, you know, hungry kids in tattered clothes. And they would start by, you know, getting clothing drives and, you know, literally washing and cleaning up kids and, you know, getting the mothers out of, you know, their torpor and out to try to help their kids get medical care. So it began in that way as a kind of classic informal, you know, women's neighborhood women's organizing network to, you know, to help others in the community and to help, you know, those poorer than themselves. But in the political context of that time, with all the war on poverty programs and with the national welfare rights movement, and, you know, with the, you know, the turbulence among young people in the 1960s that generated a large body of young law students and medical students who wanted to participate in anti-poverty work and in protest against the system of fighting poverty, such as it was in this country, AFDC, the welfare system we talked about. And so with all of that, you know, the women began to learn how to navigate the political system, and and to advocate, to lobby for their own children. And I think a key group in helping them and in allying with them was the National League of Women Voters. And in particular, they met an activist from the state capital, Carson City, Nevada, Maya Miller, who was an oil heiress who'd become an anti-segregation activist, an environmental activist, a water rights activist among indigenous peoples in the north of the state. And she was also the welfare and human rights and race relations director for the National League of Women Voters. She and other league activists began to work together with the welfare moms as mothers. They shared this vision that the work that mothers did in raising children, clothing them, teaching them, feeding them, counseling them, all had economic value in our larger system and should be respected and treated with value. And so they helped, you know, these women, many of whom had, you know, Alversa Beals had a sixth grade education, Ruby Duncan had a ninth grade education, the most educated among this group, Mary Wesley, had an 11th grade education. So they worked together with this group to help them become lobbyists on behalf of their own children, and they did it really powerfully. And so they had already begun to lobby, for example, for shoes for their children. Ruby Duncan talks about encountering Senator Lamb, the very powerful chair of the state Ways and Means Committee, and realizing when she went to the state capitol to lobby that, as she said to him, if it wasn't for you, I could have shoes for my children. This nameless, faceless welfare bureaucracy became personalized. And some of them, Ruby Duncan in particular, became quite brilliant at navigating it and lobbying on their own behalf. Then when everybody was cut off in January of 1971, the National Welfare Rights Organization was approached by Ruby Duncan and Mary Wesley and Alversa Beals, and they said, yeah, let's make a national issue out of this. And so they launched something called Operation Nevada, which brought all of these law students and welfare moms from all over the country, and there was a contingent of clergy, priests, and particularly Franciscans, and rabbis and other ministers who decided to help them try to do direct action. And that's when they stormed Caesar's Palace in March 1971 in a series of marches that for the first time ever shut down gambling on the Las Vegas Strip for several weeks running.
And we'll talk much more about that, but I should say that I'm speaking with Annalise Orlik. She's professor of history at Dartmouth College, and she's the author of Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty. That's published in a new edition by Beacon Press and is the basis of a PBS independent lens documentary with the same name, Storming Caesar's Palace. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I wanted to ask you, Annalise, about the relationship between the welfare rights movement, both nationally and in Nevada, and the civil rights movement more broadly.
Well, you know, for a very long time, the ministerial leadership of the civil rights movement had been reluctant to ally with welfare recipients because, you know, they had absorbed, you know, via respectability politics and a desire to maintain their own reputation, the stigma that was associated with single motherhood and with, you know, accepting aid. That's not to say that welfare rights activists had not been deeply involved in the Southern civil rights movement. They had, and, you know, a number of scholars are really trying to look at that now. It's a new book, I think, that Pamela Walker is doing, and Amy Jordan and Crystal Sanders have looked at that. So there have been, you know, folks getting and needing aid in the Southern movement, but the ministers had steered clear. And there's a famous story that Deborah Gray White tells in her book on the Black Women's Club movement, where the welfare rights leaders meet with Martin Luther King and some of his key allies and, you know, his key aides, and he keeps talking over them. And these women, I can't emphasize how fierce and poised and angry, rightfully so they were. And Mrs. Tillman said to Dr. King, "You know, Dr. King, if you want to learn, then listen." And King, to his credit, did not get all huffy and say, "You know, I'm this, you know, globally known leader who won the Nobel Peace Prize, and who are you?" He said, "You're right, Mrs. Tillman. I don't know what I'm talking about here. You do, and I am here to listen." And in the aftermath of that, his chief aide, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who would take over the Southern Christian Leadership Conference after King's murder, became involved in the movement. And indeed, when the Clark County Welfare Rights Organization and their allies from across the country marched on the Las Vegas Strip and stormed into Caesar's Palace in March of 1971, Abernathy was with them, and he was arm in arm with Ruby Duncan and also with Hollywood allies Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland, as well as the other women in the movement, Mary Wesley and others, when they marched into Caesar's Palace. And Abernathy helped to generate national press when he stopped in front of Caesar's Palace, which was, you know, the icon of American conspicuous consumption in 1971. And he preached to this white plaster statue of Caesar on a giant white horse in front of, you know, the fake Roman Colosseum there. And, you know, and he said, "Caesar, render unto the poor what is rightfully theirs." And so there were a lot of great, camera moments. There was a lot of great irony, you know, in the March on Caesar's, and having a civil rights icon like Abernathy coming in along with them, as well as some of the famous Hollywood leftists, you know, guaranteed a degree of press coverage that they might not have had otherwise.
We're talking about how the primarily African-American women of the Clark County Welfare Rights Organization in the late 60s, early 70s, organized against a move in the state to, well, not provide welfare in the first place and make even more punitive situation for people trying to draw on public assistance. And I wanted to ask you if you could weigh in on how the big employers of the state saw all of this, because this is before these activists actually took over their hotels and casinos by shutting down the Las Vegas Strip, because you've been describing a situation in which those employers, the casinos of Las Vegas, benefited more, perhaps, as much or more, from public assistance going to these workers as the workers did themselves, since it really was a pittance, because it allowed these people to stay in the area to do the seasonal work for the hotels and casinos. So when George Miller, the head of the welfare department in Nevada, throws people off of welfare, is there any discord amongst the business class in Las Vegas? Do we know?
There was a split. I mean, I think that by the 1970s, the industry was a little bit less seasonal than it had been in the 1950s and early 60s. But there was a split. I mean, it's interesting. The owner of Caesar's had come up behind Ruby and whispered in her ear, "Don't worry, you know, no one will get hurt. You can come in. I've talked to my staff." And I heard a fairly sensational story later via a client of Ruby's son, David, who became a lawyer and ultimately a regent of the University of Nevada system. And he said that there had been a meeting of hotel owners on the Strip, including mob and some mobbed up union bosses, to decide whether or not to kill Ruby, because in the aftermath of the Strip marches where they shut down the casinos, there were a lot of civil disobedience actions that followed, including a very famous eat-in at one of those all-you-can-eat buffets in, this was the Stardust Hotel, where they brought in hundreds of hungry children and told them to, you know, eat whatever they wanted, and then they weren't going to pay. This was when they were trying to get the state to accept food stamps in 1972. So there'd been a meeting of the owners who were just sick of this, And some of them wanted Ruby killed. And ultimately, one of the more powerful figures in the hotel industry and in the mob at that time apparently stood up and said, no more talk of this. You know, this is someone who's just fighting for mothers and kids. And, you know, this is not what we do. And it was really a turning point, I think, interestingly, you know, from which Ruby, who, you know, had, there was plenty of harassment. There were, you know, her kids talk about having to look outside. As her sons got older, they would look outside and see someone spreading petrol outside the house. Their phones were tapped. You know, they definitely felt like, you know, Ruby's life was on the line for a long time. But when the women switched from the direct action protests to working within the system, which had been recommended to them by then Governor Mike O'Callaghan, who said, look, they had one of their direct action protests had been going to the governor's mansion in Carson and showing up in the backyard where he had a swimming pool and he was swimming his laps and, you know, and demanding food for their kids. He said, you know, you've been marching long enough. It's time for you to learn how to work the system. And that's what happened in the 70s. They began to apply for all kinds of money under the community development grants and community action program. And later in the Carter years, the Comprehensive Education and Training Act, all of which gave money, federal money, to community organizations to do various kinds of work that needed to be done in their community. And so they, you know, applying for all these funds, they were able to open their neighborhood's first medical clinic, first library, first daycare center and job training programs, and a women and infant children nutrition program, all kinds of programs that profoundly benefited their community and served thousands and thousands of poor children and their families. And so the image of these women began to change, even in the idea of the hotel, the eyes of the hotel owners. And some of them, interestingly, not only did they gain an ally in the owner of Caesar's Palace, which they stormed in 1971, the owner of the Stardust also became an ally and would deliver Thanksgiving dinners to the West Side for many years after the Edens in his hotel. So they were very successful at flipping the narrative in many different ways. And one of them was this idea of fraud, right? I mean, they were really smart in, you know, the 1971 march at saying, look, this is the only state in the country where gambling is legal. The northern part of the state where the state legislators and the capital are has legalized sex work. You know, how is it that we who are mothers trying to feed our hungry kids, you know, are the ones who are supposedly, you know, committing acts of fraud and needing to be cracked down on? So they were really smart at flipping the script. And you know, it's not to say that the state didn't continue going after them. I mean, you know, as they did with many community groups during the war on poverty, there were constantly investigations to try to prove fraud, and they never succeeded. You know, they tried to paint Ruby as Ronald Reagan's, you know, welfare mother driving through the ghetto in a pink Cadillac. And they, you know, and they tried to say the WIC clinic was, you know, siphoning off all kinds of money. And there was a federal investigation of their women and infant children nutrition program, the WIC clinic. And Alversa Beals, with her sixth grade education, had developed a bookkeeping system that she could handle and that was so accurate that the audit found they were only 4 cents off. So, you know, the women were quite brilliant at running these programs, which they argued and proved they could do better than the traditionally, you know, credentialed professionals in the welfare system. And in so doing, they won a lot of plaudits. They changed a lot of minds. And one notable one was the man who was then Health, Education, and Welfare Secretary under Gerald Ford would become Ronald Reagan's Defense Secretary, Caspar Weinberger, who literally brought them to Washington for an award because their clinic was serving the highest percentage of eligible poor children of any federally funded pediatric clinic in the country. And he asked them how they did it, what their processes were, what their secrets were. And they said, it's simple. We think of these children as our own. We care about these children. And I think that became the core of their philosophy, and it affected a lot of people. Ruby said her political vision could be summed up as what any mother wants for her children, we believe a humane society should give to all children. And they tried to do that.
Well, Annalise Orlick, you're describing the movement of African-American women around welfare rights in the 60s and 70s in Las Vegas, and the shift from militant mass mobilizations to demand adequate welfare and public assistance from the state to, in the 1970s, a shift to actually, through Operation Life, setting up a nonprofit community development organization that then serviced the west side of Las Vegas and provided welfare to poor families. So a somewhat cynical question is, and I should say, of course, that the days of such programs like Operation Life were numbered, because this was in the context of really the final years of the war on poverty and federal funding for anti-poverty measures. But how would you respond to a more sort of cynical take on the shift of these women to implementing these programs, in that in the 70s, there was the waning of these large social movements demanding civil rights, demanding welfare rights, and roiling the country? Could that be part of the story?
Well, of course. I mean, there was a waning of street protest and of, of those kinds of mass actions that we saw from the 60s into the mid-70s. But I would argue that these were dramatically subversive in a different way. And I did argue that, along with a bunch of contributors, in a collection from 2011 called The War on Poverty, A New Grassroots History. And what we see is that all across the country, poor mothers, particularly poor mothers and kids of color, were actually demanding a share in governance, and in so doing, transforming, in some ways, in many ways, the governance system. And so they, you had millions who registered to vote, who ran for local welfare commissions, who ran for housing commissions, who ran for city and state, city council, state legislatures, Congress. One of the most famous of those being Maxine Waters from Los Angeles. And, so to have the perspective of aid recipients become much more integrated into the fabric of governance in the country, I would argue, was revolutionary in a different way. Now, the argument at the time, and the movement split over this, was that, making revolution in the streets might potentially overturn the system in ways that forced the creation of a more equitable distribution of wealth and a more racially and class and gender equitable system, and maybe that's true, but what we saw instead has to be, in my view, honored, and much of what they did, for example, these community health centers, the health analyst Paul Starr found they literally extended life expectancies in poor communities across the United States. You had kids who'd never been to a dentist, never been to an eye doctor, who, got their teeth cared for, got glasses, tested for sickle cell anemia. These are things that were done in the Operation Life Clinic, but they were done across the country. Food stamps is an interesting example, right? Food stamps is still very much a controversial program in some ways. The current House GOP has sworn to slash it yet again. And Democratic presidents, including Obama, participated in dramatic cuts. However, food stamps, in my view, is uncuttable, because it feeds 1 in 4 children and between 1 in 6 and 1 in 8 adults in this country. And the person who expanded food stamps the most after Lyndon Johnson and the Nixon years was George W. Bush during the 2008 recession, to prevent widespread hunger and malnutrition in the country during those hard times. So and food stamps was brought to the country by suits by welfare mother groups like this, including Elversa Beals, who is one of the lead plaintiffs in the suit to open up food stamps as a program for the entire nation. So I just want to say that I think, you know, yes, there were fewer protests in the streets, but they proved that when poor mothers are allowed to be actors in the system, that dramatic changes come. Now, I have been called the historian, the stand up and cheer historian, and I'm a hopeless optimist, but I do think, you know, what happened to the women was hard. I mean, when I first met them, they had just had the final programs taken away from them, and they were devastated. They were devastated. They really felt raw and wounded. But with time and looking back on what they accomplished, I think they have very justifiable pride. And I would say that for the whole welfare rights movement, I think it's a very understudied movement that in its own way, you know, was as important as, you know, as the civil rights, you know, revolution that led to it.
Well, let me end by asking you about the legacy of the movements of this group of women, African-American women in Las Vegas, who were involved in the Clark County Welfare Rights Organization and later Operation Life. Obviously, after the war on poverty funding ended, you mentioned Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California, demonizing Black women in particular as undeserving people drawing from taxpayers' money to live high off the hog. And of course, he then became president. And not only Republicans like Ronald Reagan, but Democrats like Bill Clinton were central to a backlash against welfare that culminated in Bill Clinton's end to permanent aid to poor mothers in 1996. Now, from the vantage point that we're at, how do you see that complicated history of the struggle for welfare rights now in an era where both austerity continues, but also the resurgence of social movements?
Well, I think the resurgence of social movements has led to a reevaluation of the social safety net and of the welfare state.
Annalise, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me on.
Annalise Orlick is author of Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty, which is published by Beacon Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. The book is the basis of a PBS Independent Lens documentary with the same name, Storming Caesar's Palace. Annalise Orlick is professor of history at Dartmouth, and her other books include We Are All Fast Food Workers Now and Common Sense and a Little Fire. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.